Autobots, transform! Not you, Bumblebee.
Welcome back to More and Less Than Meets the Eye. This is a Transformers podcast in which we flip between the critically not great Transformers live action movies and the critically acclaimed comic books by James Roberts, More Than Meets the Eye and Lost Light. This is episode 11. It's time for a movie that dares to be brave enough to ask, what if Bumblebee were just a little guy? Here to help me answer that question is Ben Phillips, who has maximum Kenergy, which I'm sure will still be a mimetic phrase by the time you all hear this. But yes, Ben, how are you doing?
I'm good. Yeah, Barbie's going to be the second highest grossing movie of the year. You heard it here first.
Okay.
It's going to beat Mario. Or not beat Mario. It's not going to beat Mario, but if Aquaman is going to leave this year, then Barbie's got a pretty clear run.
I also don't know if I like Aquaman's chances of doing it again, but I probably wouldn't have told you it would do a bill last time, so...
I mean, if Avatar did it, I don't know if it is just people in other countries like wet movies, but then I guess Black Panther 2 didn't do it, but Black Panther 1 made no offering of wet people, so...
I mean, Killmonger's costume made me pretty... Bumblebee is a triumph of a goddamn movie.
Despite having a lot stacked against it.
Zero things stacked against it. Nothing but clear, smooth sailing. Sub 2 hours. Mwah, thank you, a gift from God. And just fun as heck. A lot to consider and in terms of how it impacts other movies in the franchise and what was left and taken out and all these other things. And I know you want to spend your few minutes on Nike. And Phil Knight. And what was his rapper name?
Chili T.
Motherfucker. And Chili T. But, yeah, so, you know, when we last talked live-action Transformers, we were talking the last night. A movie so bad, it physically hurt me. Audiences felt similarly. Didn't do so good. Lost $100 million of Paramount's money. So we come, you know, Michael Bay's finally out. He said he would. He has said many times he should have stopped at 3. He wanted to stop at 4. He definitely did stop at 5. We come out with a much smaller movie in terms of budget, definitely, in terms of scope. This is almost definitely, yeah, it is a product of that vaunted writer's room where they're talking about spin-offs and smaller things. And here we are with Chili T helming it.
I feel like this is 2017, 2018 is kind of the 2 year run in which every other cinematic universe died on the vine, because obviously this is the year that Justice League came out and was like a massive flop. Like for a movie that cost as much as it did and had that much riding on it, it basically scuppered an entire cinematic universe that basically they have taken 6 years at this point pull out of that tailspin. Genuinely crazy that we are still feeling the ripple effects of 2017's Justice League movie in society. This is also the year that we tried to see whether or not Tom Cruise could support a cinematic universe with the Dark Universe. And everyone loudly said no. And Paramount...
It's just funny that I pushed publish on an episode of the pod of Pantheon Plus on The Mummy original, well, not original, 1999. And then, yes, we are, of course, talking about the big old flop of a mummy movie with Tom Cruise. Yeah, funny how those things happen.
Which was so bold to, like, change the entire Universal logo as it opens the movie, and they cast people who never got to shoot a movie and presumably got, like, massive payouts for never doing a day's work apart from one Photoshop photo shoot. genuinely insane. Yeah, and Paramount obviously going, like, well, what have we got in our franchise cupboard that we can pin a cinematic universe on? And they're like, G.I. Joe and Transformers will be the future of our company.
So funny, because they did 2 G.I. Joe movies, neither good, neither successful. Well, one must have been successful enough to do 2, but...
Yeah, but not successful enough to keep the lead actor around.
True. Oh, and there is technically, they did do a Snake Eyes movie.
They did do Snake Eyes.
I think Snake Eyes
is like 2020. It was like the one of the last movies released before. Oh no, 2021. So it was like supposed to be out. Yeah. No, it's not. It's It's Henry Golding as Snake Eyes. Uh-huh. But it's also got Iko Uwais from The Raid as Hard Master.
Mm-hmm. So pivoting back to Bumblebee, I think it was long past time to try something else. Like, I don't think they explicitly were leaving all the Last Night continuity completely in the rear view. Like, you know, there were those teasers, but like, I think this, you know, it made the least money in terms of box office gross, but like, it cost so much less than the others to make, and it was a critical hit in a way that basically none of the others were. Maybe something vaguely similar for the first one or something. I feel like, you know, if you Rotten Tomatoes this or whatever, there's a bunch of downvoting, because I feel there are some curmudgeons who demand Bay back. So but
let's run through the scores of the movies, because I've got the Rotten Tomatoes in front of me. Transformers 1, 58%, mm-hmm. solid, kind of like no one knew what horrors we were about to behold for the rest of the franchise. 20% for Revenge of the Fallen, 20. Which I feel is too high for that fucking movie. Mm-hmm. 35% for Dark of the Moon, so obviously some people were back on board for Dark of the Moon. Mm-hmm. 17% for Age of Extinction, 16% for The Last Night, so kind of there or thereabouts for those two.
Yeah.
And then 19% for Bumblebee. No, wait, sorry. 91% right. for Bumblebee.
Right, there you go. It's just better, like, in every conceivable way, and the biggest thing they did was calm the fuck down and like tighten the focus. We have, you know, we have one Autobot. I mean, Optimus does a bunch of cameos, and you know, there are some people in crowd scenes and stuff, but functionally we have one Autobot. We functionally have two Decepticons, three if you want to count the one that is killed in his first appearance in the movie, and then again, you know, all the Cybertron stuff. We have an actually fucking likable human protagonist who doesn't come with like 18 bits of back. Well, I mean, she has a family and she has a friend and there are bullies, but it's not like we have 900 useless human characters. Even the older version of Sector 7 is like less insufferable than it's been before. It's just, it knows what it's doing. And like we talked about all the way back in episode 1, they were onto something with Sam and Bumblebee, but they had too much else going on. And then many, many years later, Chili T and Christina Hodson pick that up and just fucking sprint to the end zone with it. And weird that hiring a guy who, you know, while his rise to the top of an animation studio is by just unbridled nepotism, it does have experience in animation.
Yeah, he has directed Kubo and the Two Strings at this point. Yeah. Like, he is, and has worked in animation for Paranorman, the Box Trolls, and all the rest of it. And I think he was he did a little bit of animation on Coraline as well.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. And like, he before his dad, like, massively hiked him up the company, he did, like, put in his work early on, like, cartoons like the PJs and, like, you know, stuff that no one has talked about in fucking 20 years.
Yeah, I mean, sort of like fundamentally, he was bought what was Will Vinton Studios. Will Vinton, obviously, like, one of the, like, if Aardman is one side of the Atlantic, then Will Vinton is the other side of the Atlantic, essentially. And, like, I feel like as Brits, we kind of, like, don't appreciate how big Will Vinton was in the world of stop motion animation, but, like, he was huge. He did the animation in Return to Oz,
right.
The claymation stuff in there. I'm sure you've seen The Adventures of Mark Twain, horrifying, glorifying like death sequence. He animated and was the director of that. Probably the thing that has bled most into the wider culture is he did the California Raisins as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, like hugely, hugely influential. And then basically, because in the 90s they were losing money out on Pixar and Disney, it basically put the entire studio at risk of being taken for an aggressive takeover, which is obviously what Phil Knight does. He takes control of the company, puts his son in charge of it, and they rebrand into Leica. And I mean, Leica's gone from strength to strength after that. So
that's the thing. Like, yeah, undoubtedly a Nepo baby, but undoubtedly, like, the company hasn't suffered in any way from him being on top, and he did personally direct Kubo, and Kubo rips, and like, this movie is good, and like, him approaching this movie from an animation studio standpoint leads to them coming in early on shooting, it leads to everything going really smoothly. Like, I'm sure most people have read these like horrifying anonymous tell-alls about working on Across the Spider-Verse, and like, Lord and Miller, I think, just wanting to change huge segments that had like been worked on and not appreciating how much work it takes to do that. From what I can glean, you know, I didn't work on the fucking shoot. Travis Knight, the opposite here, where he is heavily storyboarding, heavily considering like precisely how these shots with a CGI Bumblebee will play out, sticking to them, and then he delivers the movie fucking early. And well, I think they pushed it back and did some like very minor reshoots, but like generally went really smoothly. It leads to like the best human interacting with CGI Transformer acting anyone's done with Hailee Steinfeld, and part of that is they did build like a life-size Bumblebee, and they did build like a like just a head, just a chest. It's like, so I assume the scene where she hugs him and it looks like she's actually touching him, it's like, I think she is. I think they just have a big prop Bumblebee for her to hug, and then they touch it up with VFX. But yeah, all I of do, this informs how it looks, how it feels, how they shot it, and it's like, well, yeah, why would you ever go with a guy who's only ever done live action again, is my question.
Yeah, I think having an animator at the helm of this movie definitely helps. I don't think it's always a help, because it's like, sometimes these things work out really well for you, where sometimes you pull a director who works in like behind the camera or in a more kind of production role, and it like super super like works out for you, and other times it's kind of like a catastrophic failure, like Top Gun Maverick is obviously directed by Joseph Kosinski, and Joseph Kosinski is like a guy who started in CGI and all that stuff, and I think that's worked out really really well, even though kind of like he hasn't hit it every single time, but I think it does help for a movie like Top Gun Maverick to like have a guy who can visualize how this is going to look.
Tim Miller on Deadpool
at the end of the day
as well.
Tim Miller is another one where obviously he come from working at Blur, but then on the flip side of it, you've got like Robert Stromberg, who was the production designer on like Avatar, Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland, Sam Raimi's Oz the Great and Powerful, like movies with like a real sense of production design, but that look kind of bad, and then he ends up to go on to do like Maleficent, which is not a good movie. And so it's like, yes, you can pull someone who's got a sense of visual style and staging, but it's not always gonna translate.
I do feel, to be fair though, production design is a very different thing from animation. Like,
oh, 100%.
You know, you're not obviously pointing a camera, but you are like composing a shot and thinking about every aspect of it, versus, hey, I made this location look great for you, go shoot it for me, kind of thing.
And I will say, in terms of animation directors going on to do live action stuff, this is definitely more in line. I mean, it isn't as successful as Brad Bird doing Ghost Protocol, which I think is just like, that movie is more let down by the scripting and kind of like the rewrites that happen in the middle of that movie, as opposed to what Brad Bird is doing behind the camera. But like, this is better than like what Andrew Stanton did on John Carter of Mars, if we're going to compare to another Pixar guy who went from animation into live action.
Yeah, Pixar and it's has been a weird, like, cursed, like,
yes.
It's and bizarre because like, they're making all these banger movies, and yet none of it is translating to like tremendously popular sequels generally, or like anyone being able to escape, or them being able to hire anyone but two people to direct stuff.
They've kind of run out of like the big guys. They have like, either they've left the company or they're still around and kind of are doing pastiches of like far better work that they used to do. I will say it's a shame that like Travis Knight hasn't, like, I'm glad he's still doing animation, because like there's these guys should stay in animation if they can, but it is a shame that he didn't get to do like a smaller project after this one, and I can't imagine he's going to have much lateral movement into doing live action again, because this movie's not underperformance, but definitely like softer box office trajectory. But in a fun, I don't know if you know this, so his next movie is Wildwood.
Yes.
Which is based on a book by Colin Molloy of The Decemberists.
Excellent.
which might be one of the most kind of like random full circle moments.
Yeah. Yeah, that is a bizarre like little time.
Full circle. Full circle moment of this podcast.
Yeah, yeah. We will finally explain that next week. I feel we can't really go even a minute longer without acknowledging that opening on Cybertron, delivering something that Michael Bay said, nah, wouldn't look good, don't care about Cybertron, essentially, like, fuck G1, blah, blah, blah. Years of discourse around people like me who think the basically 99% of the Bay CGI designs are, like, over-designed, really spiky, really boring, no colour to them. And I'm, like, yearning for, not literally the G1 cartoon, because you look at it and it looks like fucking shit, but something a lot closer to that. And Travis Knight just shows you, you can kind of have it both ways, where they're not a million miles off, like, what Bay was doing. There is undeniably still, like, extra bits and kibble and stuff, but they are all smoother, and they have more blocks of colour, and they have more distinct shapes, and you can tell who is fucking who at every point in the movie, not just this opening. Like, we get Transformer on Transformer fight scenes throughout the movie that, like, you know who's doing what and why someone's winning. It's not just two grey things roll around and then I get a close-up on Optimus Prime, so I assume he won, kind of thing. And Cybertron itself, like, we've seen it, I guess, two times, maybe three.
I mean, the biggest opportunity was obviously in Last Night, where, like, we go down...
They physically went there, yeah.
Yeah, and that it's in Dark of the Moon.
It's in the opening of Dark of the Moon. I feel it might be in the opening of Revenge of the Fallen as well, but it might not be.
No, Revenge of the Fallen opens on Earth, doesn't it? With them,
well, I know it moves to, like, the sun drinker. Let's call it the sun drinker. who could possibly care? But no, like, Cybertron itself has, like, topography and layout and buildings and structure and bridges and the whole fucking thing looks great, and I'm sure everyone in the Transformers, like, movie fandom is probably exhausted of hearing, why don't you just do a whole movie like that for the last, like, what, 4 years at this point? 5 years?
Yeah.
And maybe that is what they're doing with Transformers 1. We still don't know what that thing is going to look like. But yeah.
Yeah, they've said ILM is going to return to provide animation, but whether or not that means it's going to look like this, or whether or not they're going to take on the fact that you've had Spider-Verse and Mitchells and Machines and Puss in Boots in the kind of intervening years and do something a little bit more stylized.
I would like that, personally. Like, I don't need it to look exactly like this for 2 hours or an hour and a half or whatever. I would appreciate something more stylized, but... Just even seeing it, and, like, you know, I've heard complaints that, like, it feels so detached from the rest of the movie, and it is, like, it was added after filming had completed, and, you know, they just went and held themselves up and made this sequence, and I think aspects of how Bumblebee arrived on Earth were changed, partially via reshoot, partially via editing, but I don't care, because it looks fucking sick, and, like... Hey, there's everyone, like, Soundwave ejects a cassette at one point, and it rips, and the fucking Seekers do, like, a little spiral move and destroy a tower, and, yeah, everyone rules, and it's great.
Yeah, it was funny watching this again with my partner in the room, who wasn't watching with me, but, like, she sat there and went, like, I don't remember this from when we saw Bumblebee in the cinema. And in my head, I was like, I think you were late coming in. I think you, like, got trapped in a bathroom queue and, like, didn't get to come into the movie on time.
I mean, they do, like, cut at some point to Optimus continuing to fight them by himself. So it's not completely left behind, but I get it. But, like, to me, it just what is achieved visually and what is teased is, like, this is what we could have of what these things look like.
I really want to know how the conversations went with the Hasbro execs. Like, was it... like Christina Hodson and Travis Knight and whoever else is, like, involved in this decision making process is sat there going, like, it kind of really sucks that we're beholden to the Bay movies, and then Last Night bombs and they've got this window and they're just like, right, what if we went full G1 in this?
People must have been whispering throughout what if more G1-esque for, like, quite a while, like, even dating back to, like, maybe around Age of Extinction or after. Like, somebody must have been like, what if you did G1 designs?
That's the thing, is, like, obviously, like, the whole thing is, this movie was supposed to have, I don't know whether or not Bumblebee was going to get, like, stuck in his alt mode during World War II, or, like, as a kind of direct sequence sequel to The Last Night, or whether or not, like,
yeah,
because definitely the thing that was, like, reshot is, like, Bumblebee crashing on Earth is new, because that's it. Because Bumblebee was on Earth apparently in the original version of this movie. He didn't have to crash down in the middle of like a 6 or 7 training meeting. And it's just whether or not like is everything leading up to him blacking out and waking up in the junkyard, is that a new addition to the movie?
I just think maybe Sector 7 discover him rather than he crashes down in front of them or something. I don't know.
Yeah, it's just interesting, obviously, that like, because that is the only sequence of the movie with Blitzwing as well, and so it's like, is that like, did they just like, they didn't have Shatter and Dropkick on the planet at this point, so is Blitzwing here purely because they were like a late addition to the movie, and or what? I mean, I say we know it's Blitzwing, but obviously everyone when the trailer came out was like, oh my god, is that Starscream?
It looks exactly like Starscream, and I was like, oh, that's perfect. You can make Starscream the main villain of a smaller stakes solo movie, and then obviously it ends up being Blitzwing, who, like, they chose the one fucking plain Decepticon who doesn't look like Starscream and said he's one of them. Blitzwing normally, like, purple, he's a triple changer, he doesn't have the, like, same exact body that, like, Starscream, Thundercracker, Skywarp, Acid Jazz, all of those, they're literally just Starscream in different colours, and they picked the one guy who's got a more unique design. But never mind. He still is good. They have a fun little fight. Like, we get some of the stuff that we've talked about a little bit in, like, well, you see it throughout the movie, where we've been wondering back to, like, the first fucking movie. Where do the bits of them go when they're transformed? And, like, that rocket has to come from somewhere. So, logically, Bumblebee can just rip that forearm off, pull a rocket out, and, like, hit him with it and stuff like that.
Yeah. I just want to say how impressive it is that you reeled off all the Seekers' names then off the top of your head with, like, nothing in front of you.
Oh, yeah. There's more than that. I can go more if you
want. I know there is, but it's just quite funny that you just were able to, like, list off all those names.
Well, those ones all rule, is the thing, and then you get into ones
that's that... That's how Transformers-pilled we are at this point, is that both of us could probably do that for a big subset of Beast
Skywarp
of Transformers.
Teleports, Thundercracker writes screenplays and has a dog, Acid Jazz is green... I'm out of the ones that are that colour. But then you got, like, Thrust and Dirge and others. Yeah, like, I think it's a fun little fight. Like, you know, you have the stuff, like, you know, I'll never talk. So he, like, fucking rips his voice box out. And Jesus Christ. Trying to, like, neatly tie that in with him crashing with Sector 7 is maybe a bit awkward. But, you know, another thing that is changed in reshoots is we have John Cena as
Jack Burns, who is a team leader of Sector 7, or...
Sure.
Another thing I didn't realise was in this movie, because I don't think the character ever gets a name, is that, like, there is someone who was cast as a younger version of Simmons
they
in
say
this
his
movie.
Name. They say
do
Simmons,
they?
Yeah.
If for whatever reason, it just completely went over my head.
Yeah, young Totoro, yeah. John Cena, originally cast to be more of an out-and-out villain. Obviously, you spend 5 minutes talking to John Cena, you're quite likeable. So, while he does remain villainous, he is given more of an opportunity to do funny stuff. So, you know, you have the pretty generic comedy bit of, like, he keeps accidentally shooting him with the, whatever, like, little Nerf gunny type things they're training with. And then, like, it makes it really... like, you really feel it when he hard swings back to, like, kill the fucking thing. And there'll be moments throughout where, like, he's like, they're literally called Decepticons. It's like, yeah, you get it. And then he's back to, like, no, we work with them to kill Bumblebee. Like, he's fine throughout the movie. Like, I wouldn't say he's, like, incredible, but, like, for the size of his role, perfectly solid.
Cena's an interesting one, because I feel like he's probably, I mean, obviously, The Rock is the most successful wrestler turned actor.
Sure.
I think, I mean, I feel bad saying it, but, like, in terms of just overall money and in terms of stardom, he is the most successful. But I feel like John Cena settled into a persona that is more flexible than any other wrestler turned actor. Like, because he can do...
Yeah. I mean, he did, like, Trainwreck, where he was, you know, he was the, like, doing the comedy stuff with Amy Schumer of, like, he's got an enormous penis. And, like,
yes,
he did that he did that movie with Tina Fey and Amy Poehler, and... Yeah,
he did Trainwreck, he did Sisters, Daddy's Home.
Yeah.
He's in Blockers this year, same
Blockers
as Bumblebee.
Was good,
He's in F9, obviously he's got Suicide Squad and Peacemaker now.
Yeah, he's genuinely really good in Peacemaker. Like, you think you know what Peacemaker is, and then, like, he really gets to show off some range in Peacemaker. Like, never completely abandons being that, like, still obsessed with the 80s roided up dickhead who doesn't know how to talk to people, but, like, there is a shocking amount of, like, room for him to act in. Much looking forward to a second season of that. One day.
Yeah, whenever that gets to happen.
Yeah.
He's got to shoot Superman first.
Yeah. I mean, nothing tops Dave Bautista's tiny glasses in Blade Runner.
Oh, no. Bautista is the best actor who's come from wrestling, I think, like, unquestionably.
Because he humbled himself. He went and did shitty fucking movies and worked his way up, rather than, like, this is a vehicle to launch The Rock or John Cena's movie career. Like, he went and put his fucking reps in. So good in Glass Onion, so good in his, like, what, minute in Blade Runner? 2 minutes?
Yeah, so good in that. I mean, I think he's still my, like, favourite supporting performance of the year for Knock at the Cabin. Like, just, he's really good. Like, really good, strong actor. Yeah. But it's like, yeah, John Cena, obviously, yeah, I think, is an easier sell to put into a movie nowadays. And he doesn't have the ego of The Rock to kind of completely consume a project under him. Where it's like, yeah, yes, he's second build in this movie. But he isn't getting in the way of Hailee Steinfeld at all. And he's not getting in the way of Bumblebee either. Like, it's just, he knows exactly what lane he needs to be in, and he performs that role well. Like, he's not, like, I mean, he probably is the best human villain in the franchise, but this is a franchise where I think the villains have been the thing that we've kind of come away and gone, like, boy, for a movie with a war at the centre of it, there's no stakes or no kind of, like, interesting villain for this thing at all.
Yeah. See, how Bumblebee, you know, he flees the military, he has his battle with Blitzwing, he has his memory and his voice box damaged. It is cute they gave him the, like, B-esque, like, Terminator mask, and, like, his like, heads-up display is covered in, like, honeycomb patterns and stuff like that. They give all these reasons to call him Bumblebee, and then she lands on, you sound like a Bumblebee. It's like, that's the one thing he doesn't resemble. Like, they even put a beehive in his wheel arch when he's stuck in the junkyard, but never mind. So yes, he assumes the form of a beetle, a VW beetle, to disguise himself, and then much time later, we meet one Charlie Watson, played by Hailee Steinfeld. Charlie Watson is my 80s girlfriend. I'm very sorry to report it. And Ben, you feel that 80s nostalgia can go die in a fire? I respectfully disagree. Because,
I mean, I look, I think this movie's coming out at just the kind of, like, past the peak of that 80s nostalgia, where, like, this feels so much that it's drafting off of Stranger Things, and how much that movie kind of, or movie, how much that TV show kind of, like, kicked 80s nostalgia into the dirt. And at this point, I'm just like, yeah, sure. I'm sure it's fine, it's fun for a while, but, like, I'm kind of,
well, over, I just think this, you can't escape that Transformers was an 80s property, and, like, it is being directed by a guy who was a rapper in the early 90s, so is almost assuredly an 80s kid. Like,
I'm not. It's,
I mean, I 4 to 5 needle drops and within, like, 10 minutes is probably a bit excessive, but, like, they get the Only Good Smith song in here. That's the one thing Charlie
There's a lot
likes.
Of Smiths in this movie.
Yeah, she really likes them, and, like, that's where we would beef, so I guess she can't be my girlfriend. But, yeah, like, she just a compelling human character in a Transformers movie, who fucking knew? Like, she has normal person motivations and problems and desires, and, like, she doesn't give a shit about kissing boys, and, like, they don't make her dress in tiny booty shorts and, like, lean over a motorbike in a ridiculous way, and, like, she's just a fucking person who, like,
yeah. I mean obviously I think a big thumb up in this movie is that obviously they hired a female screenwriter who I think is the first female screenwriter for any of these, Christina Hodson, who obviously I think is best known for Shut In, which was on the blacklist for a while before it got actually made into a movie. And now she's kind of transitioned into,
I've always thought that the blacklist sounds negative, and it's instead like, these are the scripts to watch. Like, if you're on this list, you fucking made it, kind of thing.
The thing is, the thing with the blacklist is they're all good scripts, but I feel like the thing that people don't talk about enough is that, like, quite often they're more interesting on the page than they are
when
you actually make them into a movie. Like, they've got some kind of, like, high concept to them that is very difficult to kind of translate into a movie. And I'm looking at kind of like which ones have been made now, and like Knock at the Cabin's one of those movies. The Menu was on the blacklist for a while. They cloned Tyrone, Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, Don't Worry Darling. So it's like half of those movies I like, half of them I actually kind of like really dislike. Promising Young Woman was on the list. Promising Young Woman was on that list. Queen and Slim. Like, it is a complex thing, but yeah, so she got to that movie. I've not seen Shut In. I don't know its quality, but obviously it was enough to kind of give her some juice. And she is now, I feel like, the preeminent kind of like female screenwriter for blockbuster movies, in the same way that the Meg Lefebvre, who did like Inside Out, and she wrote Inside Out and The Good Dinosaur, and she's still within Pixar, but got to do Captain Marvel, and then Nicole Perlman as well, who like was the co-writer on Guardians, and then did the story text big two. Yeah, I mean, Christina Hodson is definitely one who has been the credited screenwriter on multiple movies at this point, and I feel like there is a almost downward trajectory in her projects. Because it's Bumblebee in 2018, Birds of Prey in 2020, The Flash in 2023, and then she has been hired to write the sequel to Fast X at this point. So don't know how that movie's going to turn out, but I'm definitely not excited.
Oof-a-doof.
I believe The Flash is like such a hodgepodge of like scripts at this point that you can't lay the blame at any one person.
I didn't know she did that movie. That's upsetting. I believe Kelly Freeman Craig from Edge of 17 did an uncredited rewrite on Bumblebee. Obviously also starring Hailee Steinfeld. Shaw is suspicious that in both movies, you know, she's a teenager whose father died of a heart attack and she's struggling to get over it. One wonders if, like, all the dad stuff comes from her. And before that, she's just a generic teen who wants a car kind of thing. I don't know for sure, but whatever was done between the two of those writers to, like, make Charlie into a three-dimensional person, like, it worked.
Yeah, they've definitely put the juice in to kind of, like, do that on some level. And I think that is definitely what helps, is that, like, she feels like she has interiority and, like, an actual life outside of these movies. Because, like, when you're introduced to Sam in the first movie, it's like, okay, what do you do? Like, you just, like, your entire personality is like, I am 16-year-old boy and I have car now. Yeah. Time for me to go be horny in front of some girls. And it's like, okay, that's not...
Yeah, she's got, like, a job and, like, a complex family situation and hang-ups. And, like, she's trying to fix cars up and you know, there's all this stuff. And, like, you know, Chekhov's diving trophies at the beginning and paying that off around halfway with... be watching her dive and then having the bullies try and goad her into diving, and then she has to dive to save B, and, like, you know, it's good simple fucking stuff. You set it up and you pay it off. And also that, like, her friendship with B heals her as a person, like, throughout the movie. Like, she is strengthened by that bond, whereas, like, I feel like Sam and Bumblebee, like, I don't doubt that they're buds. I'm not trying to say that it's like Cade and Optimus where I'm like, yeah, whatever. Or Cade and Bumblebee, where I'm like, yeah, whatever. But, like, Sam sure as fuck does leave Bumblebee behind when he goes to college. And then
they have, like, no scenes together in the next fucking movie in the franchise.
Yeah. Whereas, like, I believe that these two are friends. And I believe that Charlie doesn't have many or any friends. And then, like, you know, by the end of it, she has Memo. And, you know, I guess we'll get to him at some point. But, yeah, just... It's that juice from that first one that it seems they only half knew that they had, and then it's just left there for so many movies. And, like, if you're going to do a human, and a, like, if you can do humans in Transformers and you're going to have, like, a these two are buds kind of thing, go with it. Like, actually do it. And, like, it turns out you just make the Iron Giant, or you make E.T. or whatever. And,
well, yeah, the thing is, like, obviously, like, Spielberg's notes on that first movie were presumably the E.T. stuff. I mean, obviously no one's broken it down, but it's like, when you watch that first movie, you're like, oh, this is where Spielberg would have had opinions, almost definitely. And, yeah, and it took them 10 years to turn that into an actual fucking movie, but they did. And, I mean, obviously, the other thing is I'm not going to say that Shia doesn't have charisma, because I think he does have some form of charisma.
There's something compelling about how closely he orbits madness and mania.
Yes, exactly. And that is his kind of, like, star persona that was being tapped into. Hayley Steinfeld is like an actual goddamn star.
Yeah, and another Coen Brothers fucking alum just moving over to Transformers.
I'm sad she's only worked with the Coens once.
Yeah.
But obviously she was so young in True Grit.
So good, though. Like,
she is so good. Like, in her feature film debut as well. Like, my God, like, Hayley Steinfeld. I was just going through kind of like when I've got her nominated for stuff, and I've got her like supporting actress for True Grit, lead actress for Edge of 17, and then I've also got her on like my supporting acting ballot for like Across the Spider-Verse this year, because she's like, even as a voice role, she's so fucking good in that.
She crushes like that into the dirt. And then the many awkward interviews with Shameik Moore like making her a bit uncomfortable. Proves in the first 10 minutes, oh, you could just go do a Gren movie if you wanted. They might be, who fucking knows. But I love the whole family. Like, they don't take it too far. It's not Kevin Dunn and like the dog is humping and all that kind of noisy chaos. Like, it is just like, she's got a shitty little brother, she's got a nice mum, her stepdad is a bit of a melt, but he's not like a horrible person. I mean, the closest he gets is basically telling her to smile more via a book, but then even that is like, no, look, it makes you happier, and I've noticed you're fucking sad all the time, kind of thing. So even then, he's trying to be good, but
I can't get him out of my head, because he's obviously, he's Jeremy from Broad City, who's like Abby's big crush early on, is like the guy from the pegging episode.
It's very funny when they take someone who has at some point been like a bit of a heartthrob, and then they cast them in these like really dour roles where they're like boring, and it's difficult.
I do think it's funny though, because you're obviously going from Broad City, which is like a much more, I don't want to say realistic, but it's like a heightened and obviously like takes pride in kind of casting kind of like what normal people look like. And then when you put them into a movie like Bumblebee, where you've got Hayley Steinfeld and John Cena in the lead roles, it's like, yeah, this guy isn't going to be a romantic lead. He will instead be the frumpy, nerdy kind of like stepfather.
Yeah. So she wants a car for her birthday. She's been trying to fix her father's car. She can't do it. She's frustrated. She catches sight of this VW Beetle at the junkyard where she like helps out. She's like, oh, I'll clean for a year. I'll work here for a year. I'll do whatever you want. You know, the guy just gives her the car because it's very nice. And of course it ends up being Bumblebee, and they bond, and
we finally get an answer to where their heads go.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. They keep doing it throughout the movie, and it's like, yes, correct thing to explore. And a panel does fall off, which I assume was meant to hide his face, but we know it's there. And I just want to say, like, you know, throughout these, I've largely shit on how they look, despite that ostensibly being the thing they have going for them. And we do acknowledge every now and then that, like, yeah, it does look pretty sick when, like, they transform, catch someone, re-transform, land again. I think the shot of him transforming over her is a bigger flex than any of those shots in the other movies, personally, because it looks fucking sick.
It looks cool, and also presumably, like, they probably have figured out where, like, all the parts need to go. I mean, I'm sure it probably isn't that complicated. I'm sure, like, the animator would go, like, yeah, it's kind of nonsense, but, like, you do it in such a way, and it looks good and interesting as a transformation scene. But, yeah, it is really, really well deployed, and, I think it just speaks to having an animator at the, kind of, like, staging the movie just kind of, like, really, really helps it.
Yeah, and then this is the sequence where, like, Ben, the thing is, he's just a little guy, and that's incredible. Like, as he is scared and sitting in the corner and like covering his face and, like, you know, just giving him more human-like behaviors than any of the Transformers have had before. Like, they just kind of stand there and pose, and occasionally they'll piss on someone or do just rampant violence. And B, I mean, yeah, they do basically, like, infantilize him and treat him like a dog and stuff like that. And, like, ostensibly, his intellect should be the same. He just has forgotten his name and, like, he can't talk properly. And yet he does act like this excitable little alien dog. But fuck it, it's cute, and he's just a little guy, and I love that about him. Yeah, her landing on calling him Bumblebee after the noises he makes is a choice. But yes, very cute when they bond. Can't all be good things though, and on a nearby planet. I guess, is it supposed to be somewhere we know?
It's Saturn, it's, I think, Saturn. Or it's a moon. It's a moon of Saturn, I think.
Right, I was going to say, is Saturn not a gas giant? But, okay, on the moon.
Which also comes up in the end of the first volume of Transformers self-titled. Oh, or second volume.
Sucks. Yeah.
Why, if we fight inside Jupiter?
No, it's not how it works.
Is it Jupiter or is it Saturn?
Jupiter, because it's off the... That's where the colony is being built. Let's not give that breath. When I say D-listers, I'm probably being overkind to Shatter and Dropkick. And
no,
yet...
No, we have Shatter and Dropkick toys. We both sure. have them. We love Shatter and Dropkick. they're everyone's favourites. When you look up Shatter, you definitely don't get a picture of the movie version, because I don't even think he is a G1 character.
Shatter is the lady. Thank you very much. Dropkick is the man.
Shatter is an original creation for the movie?
I don't know. I assume every Transformer exists somewhere, but if you tell me they're original, I'll believe you.
I think Shatter is original, and Dropkick is like a drone,
right?
From the TV show. So, like, right. Again, basically an original character.
Sure, but like, it's a triumph that, despite, you know, it's got all these things that everyone's always wanted, it still manages to take villains that are complete no-namers. It doesn't, like, go and dust off Starscream or whoever. And, like, you know, I'm not saying it probably wouldn't have been better if it was those. But, like, to take a combination of original character and, like, complete F-lister, Z-lister, whatever you want to call it, and turn them into maybe the best two villains in the franchise. Like, I think Laserbeak's got a certain something going for him in Dark of the Moon. I know you really like Shockwave with the big drill, but... hiring fucking Angela Bassett and Justin Theroux to voice these, like, one, that those two chose to do this movie. Two, at 0 points does it sound like Justin Theroux.
It's just especially funny because obviously Angela Bassett is this same year doing Black Panther.
Yep. Has she won BoJack an Oscar at this point? Or
I can't remember where that is. I'm looking now at her credits, but like,
I think she appears many a time, so she's probably appeared at least once already. But yeah,
she's in Black Panther, obviously, in 2018 at the same time as this, and then Justin Theroux is just finished with The Leftovers as well. Yeah. Obviously not on the same level of Black Panther, but it is just funny that, like, this is, apart from possibly Last Jedi, his like immediate follow up to. The Leftovers.
Also just a fucking Buck Wild cameo. Yeah, like, it shows you what you can do. Like, you know, they have good designs. Like, they're not completely similar to each other. They definitely aren't the generic spiky grey guys that we've had before. They end up being triple changers. I'm like, yeah, okay, fine. It does make them look a little bit extra when they, like, drive 10 feet just to then turn into something that flies. But, you know, whatever. Cliffjumper is here to... recreate, you brought up The Rock earlier, his most famous death in the first episode of Transformers Prime, the animated show, where, yeah, in I think possibly the very first scene of that show, they stunt cast The Rock to play Cliffjumper, and Starscream offs him in the first scene in an interrogation. I think it might even be done in exactly the same way with like a stabbing or whatever, but yeah, very funny that they chose to do that. They're interrogating Cliffjumper, they're like, where's Optimus Prime, where are the Autobots all gonna congregate? Around the same time, Charlie has been fucking with Bumblebee's like radio and stuff, so they pick up the signal, off they go to Earth. They wonderfully crash down on some hillbillies. Yes, they crash down on like a trailer park, and we just get some, you know, some colourful moments there. But yeah, they're quite menacing. I love Dropkick, like, turning humans into goo with his like sonic weapon. Educational to know that's what we're all made of inside. And then they will end up linking up with Sector 7 and inventing the internet, which is really nice.
Yeah, and they also do that thing that, like, so often they do in Transformers media at this point, which is, like, because they're the first point of contact with Earthlings, they get to kind of make up a story about what right. the Autobots are.
We're the peacekeepers, they're the terrorists, yeah.
Yeah, and you get that moment where, obviously, John Cena's like, they say they're Decepticons, like, we are speaking the same language. We're speaking the same language, so surely... unless they're going to come to us and say that that word means something different.
Well, to be fair, that is James Roberts inventing "you are being deceived." I think that is him that does that, and then he coins Autobots and the meaning behind that as well. And we went fucking 30 years before anyone tried to justify these names, so fair play. Yeah, like, you know, you get your generic, like, we'll work with them and then we'll advance our technology. And to be fair, they do invent the internet for them. I guess we could add this to our list of things Transformers have done in alternate Earth history. The Army did invent the internet, ARPANET and everything, so I guess they're just leaving out the fact that it was Shatter and Dropkick. You know, it's such an obvious deception and everything, and I do really enjoy Dropkick, like, objecting to it, like, this is embarrassing that we're having to, like, kneel before them and stuff.
I just enjoy, like, their entire vibe in this, because, yeah, like, they're kind of really nicely holier than thou for kind of everything. Like, this, I mean, obviously, like, spoilers for later on, but, like, when they get discovered and they, like, they finally find where B is, and they start going, like, well, now we can, like, completely destroy the Earth. And, oh no, when they find out that Optimus is coming to Earth, or all the Autobots are coming to Earth, and they're like, oh, we'll lure them here, and then we'll, like, raise the planet to the ground,
and then we'll bring all the Decepticons, and
and John Ortiz is there as Dr. Powell, and he's, like, on the radio, but, like, clearly in eyesight and in, like, hearing range, and just being like,
I do love this idea that them being big and you being small by comparison means that, like, you're quiet to them, and it's like, bitch, they're, like, made of, like, speakers and microphones. Of course they can hear you.
It's like, it's a fun kind of, like, suspend your disbelief for a moment, but it is just funny that because I authentically buy that these two would be so caught up in, like, their own little petty shit that they wouldn't pay attention to someone radioing out.
Yeah, they have a fun vibe. Plan. Like, are they, like, a married couple? Are they brother and sister? Are they just work colleagues who fucking hate each other because of, you know, familiarity breeds contempt and all that? It doesn't matter. Like, they're still fun. They have personalities.
Yeah, and I know people like to back on this movie for being kind of less visually exciting than the Bay movies, because obviously, like, Travis Knight as an animator isn't whipping the camera around every 2 seconds. There's a lot more static shots, and there's a lot more kind of, like, the way that everyone is stood around each other is kind of sitcom-y, again, probably more inducive of the fact that this movie was shot on a tighter time frame, so you're not able to do some of the stuff that Bay was probably given. Like, if a shoot for Bay was 3 months, this is probably only a month, so they're doing all of the stuff that he has to do in a third of the time. So I'm not going to blame them for that, per se. But it is, even then, they do have the kind of the moments of excess in the transformation. Like, there is the sequence of Shatter and Dropkick flying through the air in their, like, aerial modes. Mm. And then as they descend to the Earth, they briefly transform into cars before transforming into their robot forms. And presumably it is, like, to slow themselves down, because they, like, so they can run fast, but it is just funny where it's like they're literally in their vehicle modes.
That's what I mean. For, like, they're like
a second.
They're like they're so extra in how they do it. But, you know, we've gone so many movies where, like, key characters, like, transform off screen or barely transform at all, and, like, there's plenty of transforming in this movie. And, like, again, that shouldn't be difficult for that to be the heart of the goddamn thing, but the way that ILM went about it in those first five, like, it is so complicated that it must have been expensive, so they do it sparingly. And I don't know if just they found a way to make it easier this time.
Well, I wonder if it is just the fact that, like, if the actual B on screen is mostly a practical model, there is just less special effect shots in this movie. Because, I mean, also, we are not that far away from the downfall of computer-generated images in movies and how, like, fucking awful so much of everything looks. And that really isn't the case here, where, like, even if that Cybertron sequence that opens the movie is indeed entirely from reshoots and entirely made up kind of, like, after they finished production, it does look really good. It doesn't look like they were kind of running them through crunch and stuff like that to get the movie finished in time.
I wonder if they were like, well, if we're going to do reshoots anyway, and if we're going to not release it in the summer because we think it's a smaller thing, they're like, well, we might as well do this whole fucking Cybertron sequence. I mean, then. I don't know.
Literally just I've literally just loaded up a sequence of like all the transformations in the movie, and there are so many transformations. Like, and
I love that list that exists,
and so fun. Some of them, like, because one of them is the sequence where B is running away from the police car, and like he's crushing himself like a little bit smaller,
distorting himself a bit. Yeah. And you get stuff like him driving slightly off the edge and using his hand to keep on, and yeah, they really do fuck around with like partial transformations, and you know, he like just has he's got wheels down below and the rest of him is normal, and then like having to change the way he transforms to fit through a door, and just all kinds of like, this is good goofy fun where you're fucking around with like what their physiology is, and like none of is anywhere generally. Like, yeah, they gave Bumblebee a mode where like he gets guns while he's a car, but like that's not the same.
But there's so much fun stuff in the sequence where Charlie's mum has like taken Bumblebee out and she's following after them, and Bumblebee's like just got his like hand out the boot of the car, and he's waving at her.
Yeah. She's like, put that away. Yeah, really, really good. And like they go to the beach and they bond, and she teaches him how to hide, and he's never good at it for even a second. And it's, the thing is though, he is just a little guy. He musses her hair. Yeah, just really cute. And then like eventually Memo will end up, well, she uses the radio, you know, she lets him watch movies, you know, he listens to music, she ends up fixing the radio, giving him the gimmick from the first movie where like he fucks around with his radio to the point he can talk with it. Memo is drafted along because he happens to stumble across it all. He has been like trying to hit on her throughout the movie, and she's like, nope, sorry, no time. You know, he's perfectly fine. I'm not convinced you desperately needed him other than to occasionally have her explain things to him, but like, you know, he's harmless. And
I feel like he's one of those guys on shortlist because he's in the Spider-Man trilogy as one of the other kids that Peter goes to school with.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's like one of the friends in Love, Simon, and he was also in like Alita Battle Angel. So there's obviously like a hot minute where people were like, yeah, I assume it is just entirely juice from Spider-Man where it's like, oh, look at this. Like, they got Holland and Zendaya in this, and like Laura Harrier and Tony Revolori. Like,
I mean, let's be straight up with it. Ethnically ambiguous, pretty young people are always going to have work in Hollywood. Like,
very true. But like, I do
he's
think
Dominican,
there is like a level
that he can, you know, and all this other stuff.
Do you think there is like some level of people gambling on the smaller actors in that movie to kind of like go, like, one of these guys is going to pop, right? And
Yeah.
And I mean, he doesn't detract from the movie, but like when Hayley is like so effervescent as she is in this, and she has had a career of kind of like being up against very charismatic actors from a very young age, it is kind of like distracting when her main, well, not her main scene partner, because her main scene partner is a CGI VW Beetle.
Yeah.
But like, I don't know.
Felt they did hit the limits of how much it can just be Charlie talking to Bumblebee and her family, and they felt, we've got to give her someone, because they don't even land on like the romance really, because like she gives him the kiss on the cheek and he does the whole, oh, it still counts, but like she does reject his handhold at the end, and you know, whether that's just like, maybe in time, or like just a full-on no, we're friends, doesn't matter.
It's just you're coming from like Edge of 17, where like she's paired with like Woody Harrelson and like Hayley Richardson, and you're like, oh boy, like even with other people who are also massively charismatic, you're still like holding your own in kind of these scenes and stuff. And obviously Hayley Richardson doesn't pop until after Edge of 17 really, but like again, like just another massively fun personality to have in a movie. And it is, I especially when they do have someone as good as Pamela Adlon playing the mum, it is a shame that kind of the brother and the potential love interest are just a little bit less interesting.
Yeah, fucking Bobby Hill. Yeah, like they do cute, like he plays the touch on the radio, and like, yeah, very cute. We have the obligatory 80s bullying someone who's got a dead parent scene that I just truly hope doesn't happen in real life, but I'm sure it does. You know, getting into mischief with, like, trashing the rich girl's house and B getting too excited and jumping up and down on the car is pretty fun.
I feel like this is definitely something that kind of comes from people who are a little bit older in terms of bullying scenes, because I do genuinely think that, like, a lot of high schools nowadays are like the stuff seen in in Homecoming and in Booksmart and in 21 Jump Street, where like the kids were like, there's still bullying going on, but the kids are like a little bit more conscious about a lot of stuff, and
like people maybe aren't being bullied for being gay, but they are being bullied for like their fashion sense or something. Yeah,
but they also like, you would also be kind of ostracized if you were to bully someone because they had a dead parent.
Like that's just so far in, and like statistically a lot of them must have dead parents or like, you know, broken families or whatever, but whatever. Yeah, B gets into even more mischief. He like trashes the fucking house. I think the mum is remarkably cool about it, quite frankly. And you know, that's where we get the cop chase as well, as you referred to. And yeah, he accidentally discovers his like battle mask and smashes the home up. And
what, so in that scene, because obviously he's been left in the garage with like VHS tapes and music to kind of like do with what he wants. And then for some reason he's like, he just wants to go into the house, or is he chasing the dog? I forget like what reason it is for him to go in the house.
Sees a picture of her in the house.
Like, oh, okay. So,
he's like attracted by the dog and curious, and then like he sees a picture of Charlie and he just goes because he wants to know more about Charlie. And then he just smashes the fucking house to pieces.
And then he goes to watch a movie by sitting on the sofa and like splits the sofa in half.
Yeah, we've all been there.
What movies would you recommend to Bumblebee? Because obviously Bumblebee's got
The Breakfast Club. It's because he wants to be friends with Hot Rod / Rodimus and Judd Nelson. It's the voice of Rodimus. We do get the like, you know, the touching, like, you know, you found a replacement for dad with the stepdad, but like I'm never gonna find a new dad or whatever, which is all
one of those moments, one of those like remarkably eloquent moments that no teenager would ever actually be able to do, because that just like,
yeah,
like a teenager would not be able to that succinctly define the pain gap between mother and daughter, because obviously that is what immediately clicks for her mother into like, oh no, she thinks that I'm better. Is obviously like the whole reading of that, like she thinks that I've gone over her father's death as opposed to I've been able to compartmentalize and kind of like move on in a healthy way, because she is a 18 year old girl.
I have to assume that maybe he comes from the edge of 17 writer, but I don't know. But yeah, his chaos alerts Sector 7 to where he is. Sector 7 and the Decepticons rock up and take B prisoner. We get the fucking ridiculous, like, I kind of hate that it's funny because it is sort of, you know, big state surveillance thing, but like when Ron is like, oh, I stole when I was a kid, and like John Cena's like, yeah, we know. It's like, yeah, it's kind of funny, fuck you. Yeah, like they go and rescue Bumblebee. Bumblebee is being tortured, he accidentally triggers the full message. The human who was like had a fucking hard-on for Transformers realizes instantly, oh no, they're evil. Don't worry, he gets turned to liquid goo as well. Yeah, and like it is like quite uncomfortable watching these two, because like another thing is they play up that Bumblebee is small, which was a big thing in G1, that I've been saying he's just a little guy. In a different way, he was just a little guy.
Was he a minicon?
I don't know if I would use that distinction, but he's certainly on the smaller side. Like, I think he is bigger than the, I mean, we've been reading More Than Meets the Eye. He's bigger than the likes of a Swerve, a Rewind, a Tailgate, but he's on the smaller side. Yeah, I think they wield that here by making him seem smaller than he ever did in the previous five movies. And like, having these two that are like, especially like that his like battle training hasn't woken back up yet or whatever. So it kind of comes across as a lot like that scene with Ten, where Ten is getting slaughtered by the DJD in More Than Meets the Eye. Yeah, it's a little bit uncomfortable watching them just kick the shit out of him and then seemingly execute him and then fuck off. Yeah.
I just looked up a mini con on the TF Wiki, and it comes with a gif of Bumblebee attaching a helicopter to his back. But in like a way that makes no sense and doesn't seem to do anything. Like it's like he's just Bumblebee, but then they put a helicopter on his back, and it's like,
yeah,
what?
Yeah, are they saying the helicopter is the minicon in that situation?
Yeah, the helicopter's right. The minicon, and then it causes Bumblebee's front tires to come over his shoulders and then become like propeller blades.
It was a magical time.
I think this is the Unicorn trilogy it's coming from. I'll show you the gif at some point, but I won't do it now. But it's just a magical moment of like, what if they did that in this movie? What if Bumblebee attached a helicopter to his back and used his tires to
like become he fucking kills Dropkick and then claims his blades, which is about to happen. Like Charlie shocks him back to life using the electro things they knocked him out with before. He briefly goes psycho mode and starts like destroying Sector 7 vehicles.
Yeah. It's been mentioned, but like this,
it's the Iron Giant.
I feel it's the Iron Giant, and the Iron Giant is a better movie because I think the Iron Giant's got more time and like narrative economy to invest into the relationship between the Iron Giant and Hogarth.
No, yeah, I guess you are, I suppose, correct. But
I mean, I'm not saying that they don't have to. I also think that there is probably a beauty in the Iron Giant learning Earth culture and kind of learning to be a hero versus Bumblebee learning how to be human through pop culture, I think is kind of that difference. Like Hogarth is teaching him like guns are bad and like you need to be a hero, whereas in this Charlie's like the Smiths are good and
here's Rick Rolling.
Here's Rick Rolling and like here's you learning how to speak through the radio. Like they give that an origin in this movie of him. Yeah. He's basically fascinated by what it actually means, because it basically is like either has Bumblebee made a load of recordings of like different words
maybe
that he can deploy at any moment, or is he just constantly aware of every single radio station that is airing right now?
Yeah, and he's like a step ahead and he's like, right, I need to change to 104.3 to get the word never. Yeah, Edgar Wright shaking in his boots while doing Baby Driver. Yes, they, you know, there is this brief standoff, but then off they head to this little Decepticon tower and, you know, big fight. Ron doing fucking ridiculous stunt driving to make Sector 7 late to the scene. I love when Bumblebee puts her in the garbage to protect her and then plays I Would Hate for Anything to Happen to Her or whatever. Just gorgeous animation. Just here you go, in you go to the garbage. And then, as I said, we get actual fight choreography where, like, they're doing things to each other. It's not just rolling around and shooting the weapons. We get this wonderful homage to a G1 shot where, like, Dropkick throws Bumblebee and he responds by just transforming and just hitting the ground and driving and then turning around and driving back into him. Like, fun little thing.
I love the sense of momentum that they're able to, like, because it's like Bumblebee wouldn't be able to punch them this hard, but if he was driving at like 90 miles per hour and then turned into a robot, he'd carry the momentum in. Again, those things were like, they're actually thinking about how these robots interact with the real world, even if the camera isn't doing the crazy shit. They're more interested in letting the actual characters do crazy shit. Yeah. And I think it's a payoff that works in this movie's favor, because it means that the decisions that characters are making are based in character, as opposed to you are aware that Michael Bay is guiding your point of view through things that he enjoys.
Yeah. Yeah. And I like the Dropkick kind of starts to do it back to him, where he like is thrown, he drives up, but then he turns into a helicopter because he's got that extra mode on him. But then Bumblebee, like, again, answering things that we have asked, like, what happens if you fuck with the mid-transformation? And it turns out, if you chuck a chain on him and it gets caught in his blades and then he transforms, and then that wonderful line read of, like, you think these chains can hold me? And they're just pulling him into pieces. And something I really enjoy is that I think all three villains defeated in this movie explode in a very... It feels very Saturday morning cartoon, where, like, you know they're dead because they went boom. Like, Team Rocket are blasting off again.
But they don't do that thing that the Bay movies have done where, like, Energon like, comes out and it's, like, green and stuff like that. Like, it feels more friendly for children.
Yeah.
And like, it's still violent and there's still stakes, but it's definitely not in that level where it feels visceral and they're trying to appeal to like tween adult demographics.
It should be said they weren't allowed to use the VW Beetle for Bumblebee before now because Volkswagen complained about the like level of violence and action and stuff, and then knowing this was going to be a more family-friendly affair, they're like, yeah, no, go for it. Which, you know, maybe no huge loss that they weren't able to do it, but Yeah, so he beats Dropkick. Charlie interferes with Shatter's attempt to broadcast. Bumblebee fights Shatter. Shatter basically kicks the shit out of Bumblebee. but then he like blows a dam and like slams a freighter into her, and that's goodbye for her. Charlie has to do the big dive to save him. Not entirely clear on, like, you know, what exactly she was doing to save him, but, like, you know, just, yeah, it's more, just it's being more that, there was enough.
Yeah, it's more that bringing it full circle, like, here's a thing that she can do to kind of, like, save him.
Yeah,
I do think it's interesting that this movie is so slight.
Yep.
Like, I mean, and obviously, like, it's smaller budget, it's shorter shoot time and stuff like that, but you think about how much extraneous bullshit that we have to talk about with all the other movies. And
meanwhile, Josh Duhamel has Optimus Prime's body flying around the world.
Yeah, and instead this movie is like, yes, there is like fundamentally less things to talk about, because it's like there's only so much you can talk about. Charlie shows Bumblebee some music, and then yeah, she has some like banter with her family. It's all character building, but it's all like super easy to kind of like summarize really, really quickly, and we don't need to dwell on in the way that we have the other movies, where it's just like so much insane stuff goes on, and you kind of get exhausted explaining the plot of those movies. Whereas this one is just like, no, this is an Amblin ass movie. Like, this is the like we. You talk about it in the way that, like, Spielberg is a producer on the other Transformers movies. This is the first time that feels like they're actually aping his style in a way that actually helps. In a decade where, like, lots of people were chasing the Amblin style, we've already mentioned Stranger Things, but you've also got, like, J.J. Abrams' attempt with Super 8. And all of these things, they're, like, chasing this same 80s nostalgic look and feel of how these movies are, how they present family, and kind of, like, coming from... I mean, Spielberg is obviously the ultimate divorced family guy, making so many movies about like relationships between sons and fathers and whatnot, or like what it's like to not have a father in your life in the way that you kind of like want them to.
And then Nolan's making movies about criminals, and it turns out the other brother is a fucking hitman, maybe.
I don't know exactly what his brother is, but his brother is a criminal, and obviously like is a
not
big
Jonathan.
Part of that, and...
Obviously, everyone should. No. But yeah, his
not
brother's
the American,
a
not the American brother, his British brother, I think, because Nolan's like Christopher Nolan is the middle one, who's kind of both British and American.
Right. Okay.
But like, apparently, like his older brother had like the call sign like Oppenheimer as
just
well.
People... Incredible to learn, like right up there with learning that like Woody Harrelson's dad was a hitman and maybe killed JFK. Like what? And then learning maybe Matthew McConaughey is his. Long lost half brother. Incredible things.
But that thing is like this movie is going after that Amblin style and is succeeding at it. I don't think there's not like a lot going on under the hood, because as I say, like maybe if Kelly Freeman Craig had like written directed this movie, you'd have something that actually had a little bit more on its mind about the idea of kind of like dead fathers and broken homes and the such. And instead. I think
you need more human characters for it to... I mean, we've got the bullies and we've got Memo, but, like, I think to pull that off, how does Charlie talk to Bumblebee about what it means to have a dead parent when he can only reply with radioisms, you know?
No, I know, but then maybe it's just that maybe we're asking for a different movie. Maybe it is a world in which Bumblebee assumes Optimus is dead and they're bonding over over that kind of thing.
Yeah, maybe.
Like, again, there's something...
The thing is, if you get into that territory, I'm afraid you've just written an Oscar-winning movie, so like, it can only be so powerful before...
But yeah, I think it is both this movie's strength and weakness in that it is this kind of slight, but it's also like, ah man, like you've stripped away all the things that kind of suck about the Bay movies, and you've put in something that feels like that has weight and we know works on a cinematic level, but you've kind of only filled it like 60% of the way full. And if there was someone with more of a take,
I just
would
think,
this be elevated to like this is a great movie rather than this is a good movie?
I just think the other five existing helps it a great deal, because like night and day by comparison, and like such a breath of fresh air after like a decade of like schlocky, noisy Transformers movies to then have something that yeah, it is simple, but it like sets him up and knocks him down and gets out of there in under 2 hours, and like I will take that every goddamn time. And I actually think like the ending here where like they go their separate ways, they each deliver a line that genuinely is heart-wrenching for me. Like him saying thank you so much for giving me my voice, and her replying thank you for helping me feel like me again. Like, fuck yeah. Like come on, let's make movies.
Yeah, I mean, I have no complaints here. I mean, I think I texted you on this where it's like, more blockbusters should be made in this kind of budget range. Like, limit them to...
Mm.
I mean, the reported budget on this movie is $102 to $135 million. I have to assume a chunk of that is coming from asking to do a Cybertron except piece at the end. And maybe the original budget of this movie was like a clean $100 million. And you look at Prey...
Mm.
And just like, boy, why can't we do movies that are a little bit more practical, movies that are a little bit more smaller scale and don't need to make don't have the expectation of doing $1.5 to $2 billion on them? Like, why do we need to have the Flash and Fast X and Indiana Jones and Mission Impossible all expected to do these like crazy numbers when you could make them for half the money and still have kind of like something that's got some like genuine filmmaking craft behind it.
There's all this talk right now with the strike on that, like, you see these fucking dickheads who are like, you all deserve to lose money because you keep making shit stuff. And it's like, no, it's just the way execs are going about the business of movies these days is not sustainable and it's not good and it's not artist driven. And like, $200 to $300 million budgets cannot be a regular thing. It needs to be a, like, once every so often there's this giant ass movie and I can see every dollar on the screen. I look at this and I look at like The Last Knight and like their budgets, and sure, there is more of The Last Knight, but I can't sit here and tell you that like The Last Knight looks like $100 million better than Bumblebee looks. Like, to me, Bumblebee looks better because of the character design. I know like there's something to be said for blocking and camera movement and stuff like that, but to me, the combination of like the character designs and the set design and the way that Haley is like very clearly actually interacting with a thing, all of that is more pleasant on the eyes to me than this big fucking muddy 500 Transformers, none of them with names, all just shooting into the void, like, whip pan around a military vehicle. Like, all of that is headache inducing to me.
But yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot to be said, the fact that we're recording this episode the day after the Barbenheimer weekend, and how both of those movies have sub $150 million budgets.
And all those famous people are in Oppenheimer, so it can't, like, people talk about, like, well, you got those actors you've got to pay. I was like, no, you fucking don't. Like, they don't all have to be paid, like, $20 million each. Like,
there are, like, four Oscar winners in Oppenheimer, and, like, one Oscar winner has got like a 2 second cameo where he obviously had to get into a shitload of makeup. Like, if you are someone, if you are making a project that people genuinely care about, then you will find a way to kind of like strip your quote down and stuff like that. You can make, if you can make Oppenheimer for $100 million with that cast, then what the fuck are we doing?
Yeah. What kind of like are elsewhere? We doing is a very fair question to ask. Get our obligatory, you know, he turned into a Camaro. He drives alongside what is clearly Optimus Prime on the Golden Gate Bridge, which just completely destroys any sentiment that, like, you know, that it could possibly be a prequel to the first movie, because Optimus arrived on Earth in that movie in 2007, but whatever. Like, they cut any explicit ties with the older movies. Like, they delete a Megatron scene where Sector 7 have a more G1-esque Megatron under their watch and stuff like that, but... Yeah, you know, it's all there if you want to play with it, and, like, you can do a direct sequel, and...
What do we think of the mid-credit sequence with, obviously, like, the six or seven kind of, like, new Autobots arriving?
Yeah, good.
it's weird, because, obviously, like, the original intention was, I think, was to, like, have it be, like, a cheeky thing where it's, like, we're going to have the original truck that Optimus is based on, and we're going to have a VW Beetle or whatever driving next to each other, and then, obviously, it becomes the Corvette.
Yeah.
Like, and it's just going to be, like, it's not actually Optimus, and then they added the post-credit sequence of setting the sequel up, which has got, like, a whole load of new Autobots arriving on Earth, which is presumably the cast of Rise of the Beasts, which is like, so like Mirage, so,
yeah, I mean, RC. As of this recording, I have not seen Rise of the Beast. That is obviously our next live-action movie. You know the degree to which the things they set up in Bumblebee as a... Because I feel like at the time this came out, they were being a little bit coy about, is this a prequel, is it a reboot, is it completely its own thing? And then they landed on, it's a reboot, we're doing our own. Like, the next movie will maybe not be Bumblebee 2, but it will continue what Bumblebee sets up, and it is not beholden to Bay. You know at this point how much of that ends up being true and what fuckery happens. I am looking forward to finding out in 2 weeks. Better or worse.
I mean, I will say, it is... Even if this movie doesn't do... Like, it only gets to, like, kind of $468 million at the box office. So, like, it definitely is a drop-off from the last movie. I mean, how much of a drop-off was it? I'm looking now.
But what world are we living in where, like, making... Well, box office of like, just shy of $500 million is not a very, very good thing. Like, even with marketing, you must have made double your spend.
Yeah, I mean, last night does 605, this does 468, so about $130 million less, more or less. Yeah.
And some of that is you've, at this point, has the West fumbled the bag with China? Like, and maybe not quite, maybe just people were less interested in this because there's no Optimus Prime and there's no, like, tease of all that, and Michael Bay, for better or worse, is a director who people go and see his movies. I don't know. Or maybe people assumed it's, like, more childish or more comedic. Or
but yeah, whatever. The thing, even with that drop-off in kind of like how much money this movie made and all the rest of it, I don't understand how your first instinct isn't to ask Hayley to come back.
Absolutely. I was literally about to say, like, maybe you're saying you've tied off her character's story and, like, it doesn't make sense for her to come back to the world of Transformers, but, like, why isn't there a Bumblebee 2? Why isn't Charlie back in some way? Like, why isn't Rise of the Beast, like, Charlie and Memo on another adventure? Why have we got a completely new human protagonist? Why isn't Travis Knight back? Why isn't Christina Hodson back? Like, from what I know of Rise of the Beast, they literally did what they did with Last Night, and they took two separate ideas, one being a direct Bumblebee follow-up and one being a Beast Wars movie, and just mushed them together. And why did you not bring any of the creative team of this movie forward with you? Why did you not bring Charlie with you? Especially with Hailee Steinfeld. Like, so many people caught her early. Like, she had been in good things, like, very visibly before this. But, like, for them to get her for the MCU in Transformers, in Spider-Verse, all this stuff. And now I'm not saying she's Florence Pugh, but, like, she is a name that, like, people pay attention to, like, when she's in things.
I do wonder if it is just kind of, like, a victim of circumstance where, like, she obviously gets quite busy after this because, like, she does Dickinson. There's rumblings for ages before they eventually say that she will be playing Kate Bishop. Like, yeah. I feel like that was known pre-pandemic and she, like, was very, very quiet about it. And then obviously, like
fucking spotted with a dog at a train station. Like, come on.
Yeah. I do wonder, though, whether or not it is a thing where, like, she gets Bumblebee, she obviously gets Spider-Verse, she's doing Dickinson, she's cast in Hawkeye, and it's just her schedule filled up.
Yeah,
and
maybe.
At the same time, they're looking at who to bank on next, and one of the stars of Hamilton, who is just about to lead a big budget like musical movie that's from the writer and director of Hamilton, all the rest of it. Like, yeah. is this the way that we're going to go? You gamble on that, and then I'm not saying that, like, Anthony Ramos hasn't gone anywhere, and we'll obviously discuss that next week. But I do think it was like, I wonder if in different circumstances would they have gone for Hayley again?
Like, does she want real money this time? Although, you know, she's fucking doing Hawkeye, so she can't be making that much money. Yeah, just if there had been a way to, maybe she's not the second lead or even the main lead, but finding a way to give her, like, a 10-minute segment where, like, oh, Charlie's here, kind of thing. Anything would be welcome. And, like, I don't think they've completely ruled out doing a Bumblebee sequel. I mean, again, I don't know what, something might happen in Rise of the Beast that would prevent it, but, like, I do know that both Knight and Hodson had ideas about a sequel. We'll see what happens.
I just think that Hasbro are in kind of, like, it's such a weird position right now, yes, where it's absolutely, like, it feels like they could announce Bumblebee 2, Last Night 2, and Rise of the Beast 2, and I don't think anyone would be surprised, but I don't think anyone would be excited either, apart from those sickos on Twitter who are like, give me anything. Like, I mean, I've been inundated with, like, the digital versions of, like, Rise of the Beasts are out online now, and people are, like, revisiting shots and going, like, man, this was such a great shot, and I'm like, oh, yeah, I guess that was a thing from that movie. Yeah,
absolutely. Right, well, we will be talking about that in 2 weeks. Next week it is the Comic Zone, though, as we, you know, as Bumblebee has rebooted the live-action movies, comics are soft rebooting as well. What was More Than Meets the Eye is now Lost Light, and we will be reading Volumes 1 and 2, which is issues 1 to 12. A lot more issues than used to go into a volume, but they're all 2 pages shorter, so maybe it evens out eventually, I don't know. But
I genuinely think we've read, like, if you exclude Dark Cybertron, every episode we've done has, like, added one additional comic onto, like, what we had to read. It was like, the first one's 8, and then it's like 9, 10, 11, 12, and then the final one will be the last 13 issues of the entire series.
Look, I don't control how they put them into trades. I just know how numbers fit together when planning a podcast, Benjamin. but yeah, that is next week. If you are reading along, and then 2 weeks' time, Rise of the Beast, you can at us on Twitter. Maybe it's X officially now.
No, we can't give this to him. It is Twitter forever.
Yep.
We're not going to acknowledge that they've changed the fucking logo or anything like that. It is Twitter now and forever, and we will bully him into, like, losing a shitload of money again.
Well, on there, we are Maltmitte, M-A-L-T-M-I-T-T-E, enterthereworld.com. You can find us. You've already done it if you're listening, but we are everywhere where you can get a podcast. Search More and Less Than Meets the Eye. Thank you, Benjamin, for, you know, helping me through this journey of Bumblebee as a little guy. For me, a wholly successful experiment.
I don't think you said this, but is Bumblebee a little guy?
The thing is, he's just a little guy. audience, roll out.
This is why we fight, why we lay awake. This is why, this is why we fight. Die, we will die with our arms unbound. This is why we fight. So come to me now. Lay your arms around me. This is why. This is why.